Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
Welcome back. So the news from Dortmund is as expected. The game this evening has been called off. It will take place tomorrow night, 7:45 kickoff. If you're just tuning in, there was an incident involving the Dortmund team bus. There was an explosion of some kind. We're not entirely sure yet the nature of the explosion. Borussia Dortmund, about half an hour, 25 minutes ago, confirmed their bus was involved in an explosion ahead of the game against Monaco. Defender Mark Bartra was reported to have been taken to hospital. His injuries not reported as being serious. A statement from local police said, in the run-up to the Champions League match of Dortmund against Monaco, there was an explosion near the Dortmund team bus shortly after 7 p.m. According to current knowledge, the windows of the bus, whole or partial, were shattered. One person was injured. It's not yet possible to say exactly what the explosion was or exactly where something exploded. So the statement also added, the bomb exploded at the team bus next to the hotel. The players are safe. There is no danger at the stadium. There was a tweet from the Dortmund account an hour before kickoff. At our bus departure, an incident has occurred. One person injured. More information to follow. They later tweeted, bomb explosion on the team bus at the team hotel. Players are in security. No danger at the statement. So the latest news is that the game has been postponed and it will take place in Dortmund tomorrow night. The reports from Germany are that the injured player was the Spanish international Bartra. So, 26-year-old taken to a local hospital and injuries not thought to be serious. So, really, from the moment the news came through, it was fairly obvious this game was not going ahead. And we've had confirmation of that in the last few moments. So, doesn't seem to be a dreadful, overly serious situation in Dortmund. Just Mark Bartra with the injury. And we don't know about the nature of the explosions or the explosive devices. So as soon as we get your news, we'll bring it to you and we will be over to Dortmund and hopefully speak with a voice over there in the next while and keep everybody up to date with what's going on. There is a game going ahead in Turin between Juventus and Barcelona, repeat of the 2015 final, which finished 3-1 to Barcelona. Much has changed since then, particularly at the Barca end, although Juventus have a radically new midfield, including Paulo Dybala, 23 years old. Tim Vickery is on the line. Paulo Dybala, Tim, interesting. And there's a South American flavour to this entire contest. Dybala, in his press conference yesterday, making the point, I am not the next Lionel Messi. Please stop calling me the next Lionel Messi.
Yeah, well, I suppose the coincidence is that he started his career relatively unknown to the public back in Argentina. And he only played second division football in Argentina before moving over to Italy and doing very well there. So, you know, he's got the task of making himself known to his own public, if you like, without playing in that strip of Barcelona. And he has been involved in World Cup qualification, but very little. He's only started one game and he got himself sent off in the first half. Apart from that, a couple of innocuous substitute appearances. So when the Argentine audience sit down to watch this game, from the start, they're much more interested in watching Messi than they are in watching Dybala. And it's up to Dybala to do something about that.
Juventus signed him for €40 million 2 years ago. Gonzalo Higuain, who's Juventus' top scorer this season with 27 goals in all competitions, has described him as looking like Messi. Arrigo Sacchi drew a similar parallel. Maradona simply described him as a phenomenon, didn't want to necessarily compare him to Messi. To call anyone the next Messi seems a bit crazy. But how good is this guy? How good can he be?
Well, he's very, very impressive indeed. And in Argentina, he was more in that second division season with Instituto of Cordoba. He was more an out-and-out striker. And it's going to Italy, playing alongside the likes of Higuain and Mandzukic, has dropped him a little bit deeper, hence the comparisons with Messi, which is, I think, a headache for the next Argentina coach, whoever that may be. They just sacked their coach yesterday. We don't know who the replacement is going to be. How do you fit Messi and Dybala into the same starting lineup? Can it be done? It's almost as if Argentina have this embarrassment of riches going forward, and they must look at people like Dybala and think, well, why can't you just be a centre back for once in your life?
We mentioned the South American flavour to the whole thing. So Dybala and the Messi comparisons have gone on. Has Messi been generous towards him? I saw when Dybala was sent off on his debut that Messi gave him a pat on the head and seemed to be, you know, trying to give him a bit of a pick-me-up because he was very upset, Dybala, when he was sent off on his debut. Publicly, has Messi been good to him?
Yeah, I think so. And he's, I think he's a good teammate and a Messi and a positive presence in the group. One thing which I think will be very interesting to look at in this game is the effects of the World Cup qualifiers that we've just had. And Dybala didn't manage to get on the field; he wasn't fit enough for those two games that Argentina played. Messi, of course, did get on the field against Chile, travelled up to Bolivia. Then was his suspension was announced and he didn't get on the field. You know, Suarez was on the field for one Uruguay game. Neymar in quite brilliant form for the two Brazil games. Now, remember this time last year, when did Barcelona's season go off the rails? Exactly at this point, right after the two games of World Cup qualification in South America at the end of March, when for the first time in the campaign, Messi, Suarez and Neymar all travelled across the Atlantic together. So, you know, long journey there, grueling games in the middle, long journey back. And for a team like the current Barcelona side, perhaps a little bit different from that one of the 2015 final that you mentioned. And this is a side which now does look more dependent on flashes of inspirational individual play rather than the collective rhythm that they used to build up. Last year, they paid a price for the participation of their star players in the South American World Cup qualifiers. This year, well, have they planned any better? Or is it something which is going to affect the opponents as well? You know, Daniel Alves, now the Juventus right back, he played in those games. Gonzalo Higuain also crossed the Atlantic, as did Cuadrado. So this could be a game where those recent World Cup qualifiers have an effect on the quality of the spectacle.
You were writing about Neymar recently, who has scored his 100th goal for Barcelona. He's scored over 50 goals for Brazil. He's still only 25 years old. He's not been having the greatest of seasons. And you know, we saw at the weekend, he was sent off. He was sarcastically applauding the referee. There's accusations that he's playing with his boots in the last four games purely as a marketing ploy to get some screen time for them. And there were similar accusations that he was doing it with his underwear about 5 or 6 years ago. He's denied them. Enrique has denied them as well. But those last 6, 7, 8, 9 minutes against PSG were almost so spectacular. They've changed the whole vibe around Neymar.
They have, yeah. And I remember doing a TV program over here in Brazil with a journalist based in Madrid about 2 months ago, saying, you know, we're all worried here in Spain about Neymar and his form. He seems to have dropped off this season. Is he losing focus? And then those last 10 minutes against PSG, it just seemed to have taken him up to a new level, and he took that form into the World Cup qualifiers. He was sensational for Brazil in those two games. But he does remain a petulant figure. You know, with great powers comes great responsibilities. Can he do it under pressure week after week after week? Can he be the leader of the pack at Barcelona? Is the baton changing hands from Messi to Neymar? If so, is Neymar capable of living with that pressure on a week-by-week basis? He'll always be a high-profile player and a very difficult player to referee. It's the way he plays. He's not a street footballer. He's a footballer who's been hot-housed. So as he's come up through futsal and something, there's always been the presence of the referee there. And you see his way of defending himself, a street footballer, say Carlos Tevez, defends himself by giving the pass at the right time and getting out of danger. Neymar defends by trying to force fouls. And if the referee doesn't agree with his criteria of what is a foul, then that relationship can be very, very difficult indeed. So that level of petulance that he carries around with him is going to be tested now after that PSG thing. He's seen as the man who can tip the balance.
That's really interesting. In all the years talking about Neymar, that's the first time I've heard that point made, that he grew up in the futsal environment with the referee at all times, as opposed to the Tevez, Suarez types. And it's, you know, as soon as you said that, illustrated that point, I could just see in my mind how he does play the game very much with the referee in mind at all times.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like, you know, the great film Raging Bull. you see sometimes through the, it's about a boxer, Jake LaMotta, and sometimes you see things from the point of view of LaMotta in slow motion. The great athlete sees things in slow motion. You know, the athlete who's being overwhelmed, everything's going too fast for him. But Neymar is an incredible player, and he sees things in slow motion, including opportunities to get fouls. Mm. So he'll see a way of himself forcing the contact, and then he'll do one of his theatrical dives when he kind of leaps up in the air and then comes down. And he gets very upset if he doesn't get his fouls. It means that the it raises the emotional ante because it really annoys the defenders, it means that there's the permanent possibility of friction between Neymar and the referee. And we've seen this with Brazil. He got a long ban for pushing a referee in the Copa America game in 2015. It's the only time in a senior game for Brazil, it's the only time he's been on the losing side, and he couldn't really cope there. It brought the petulant side of his nature to the surface. And as more responsibility will be given to him at Barcelona, the possibility for that friction and raising the emotional stakes of the game, that will rise, and it'll be fascinating to see how well he can cope with all of that.
Barcelona are in tricky form and at a tricky place to try and analyse with any certainty. They haven't won two consecutive away games since September, which is quite extraordinary in La Liga and beyond. We saw obviously what happened in the first leg, the Champions League last day out. There is talk that Enrique, quite understandably, doesn't have the same control over the dressing room with his departure imminent. There's a sense that the squad hasn't been replenished given the retirements, and the board haven't done right by the players in many ways. And therefore, the games like the one at the weekend against Malaga are not being ruthlessly disposed of like they were in the past, but that when it comes to the big games, the players are getting it together. Is Neymar the type of character who needs the whip cracked across a season by the manager?
Yeah, perhaps a little bit, and perhaps he can drift a little bit, but he also needs confidence. Another thing from his career, which is absolutely vital to understand him, he failed, and he failed very badly, in the World Under-17 Cup back in 2009. At that time, he was already a first-team player for Santos and a domestic star. So he expected to breeze through the World Under-17 Cup, and Brazil got knocked out in the first round. And he kept on getting substituted when Brazil needed a goal because he just wasn't doing it. Mm. That really, really knocked his confidence. And that, I think, is something which delayed his move to Europe. When his confidence is flying, he is capable of things that no other player in the world can do. Mm. But when his confidence is a little bit down, he is much, much easier to mark. Daniel Alves is not the greatest defensive right back. What a clash this one is going to be.
Yeah, Barcelona have scored 25 goals in the Champions League this season, almost twice as many as Juventus. And naturally enough, living up to cliches and traditions, Juventus have the tightest defence in the competition.
Yeah, which will be tested. And it's tested by the way that Luis Suarez, I think he's the best in the world at playing on the shoulder of the last defender. And he forces that defensive line deep. It was responsible for one of the key goals against Paris Saint-Germain, which also helps create space for the likes of Messi and Neymar. Now, how do you line up your defence with those twin threats of Messi and Neymar? Neymar wide left, Messi from the right. It makes the pitch very big. Mm. How do you line up? And Neymar, I think, perhaps against Paris Saint-Germain, benefited from the attention that the Paris defence were giving to Messi. How do you cope with that? Do you now put more on Neymar? Will that open up space for Messi? So if these three are not jaded by what they've just been doing in the service of their national teams in World Cup qualification, it looks like the battle of the Champions League so far, you know, between that Juventus defensive unit and the MSN attack, which on its day is so sparkling.
Yeah, Suarez, unlike Neymar, a man still coming to terms with the notion of a referee.
Yeah, yes.
Getting there slowly.
Yeah, well, he's 30 now, so, you know, perhaps by the time of his testimonial, he'll have got there.
One last question. So we've talked about Dybala going forward. I mentioned Higuain, 27 goals in all competitions, which seems really impressive. Is he a starter for Argentina? Is he the main man for Argentina these days?
Been in and out. So there's another centre forward, Lucas Prato, who sometimes has been starting ahead of him. But that, I think, will change. with the new coach, whoever that will be, you know, and whoever this coach will be. It is bizarre that it seems to, that the two candidates, the Argentine FA, are travelling across the Atlantic. They want to speak to Jorge Sampaoli and they want to speak to Diego Simeone.
Right.
So, you know, that raises the question, do they know what they want? You know, these are two coaches of totally different styles.
Yeah.
But whoever it is who gets the job, whether they convince one of those two to turn their back on the Champions League next year, or whether they have to lower their sights a little bit, one of the key decisions will be, well, who am I going to go with? You know, from all of this embarrassment of attacking riches, who is going to be number one and we're going to stay with that? And I think that's because at the moment Argentina look like a shambles. There are shambles on the field and even more of a shambles off the field. Whoever comes in will have to sort out what is my team and let's stick with it for a while.
Yeah, Dybala just on his first touch got absolutely hacked down by Iniesta, so he can expect more of that this evening. Final prediction, who are you fancying tonight?
My prediction probably over the two rounds is Juventus, but usually I always make my predictions after the event, and I think I'll probably stick to that one now.
It's good policy. Tim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Tim Vickery there in Rio. 2-3 minutes gone in Turin, Juventus against Barcelona, no score yet. As I said, the only real action of note is Dybala, who we've been talking about getting the ball, Iniesta hacked him down, and the resulting free kick was swung in to Higuain's head. And he put it straight at the goalkeeper. It was actually a great chance for Higuain, but he could only direct the header straight down the middle of the goal. So nil all there. And if you're just tuning in, the Dortmund-Monaco game has been called off. There was an explosion in or around the Dortmund bus. Details are sketchy. Certainly confirmed details are sketchy at this stage. But there was an explosion of some kind in or around the Borussia Dortmund bus. The windows were shattered. Mark Bartra, one of their players, was injured, not seriously, we're hearing, and has been taken to hospital. So, naturally enough, the game has been postponed and it will go ahead tomorrow night.
Off the ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competitions.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had bought, he'd be the granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's right.
So, Dan McDonald, as you know, one of my favourite listeners to the show is, of course, the Walkinstown Beckenbauer.
You talk about him on air and off air.
He talks a lot of sense. Does the Walkinstown
gets to the heart of the issue.
Beckenbauer, I agree with a lot of his sentiments, a lot of his takes on the game. He's got a man shed where he often listens to the show. Another aspect of his life which I appreciate and admire. We've just had contact from the Luke and Messi.
Oh,
The Luke and Messi, I'm not as familiar with.
Is this a new departure for him?
I don't remember the Luke and Messi before.
This is like you start off with sort of Lidl and then you end up with Aldi. Like, you know, is this sort of a rival effectively?
Well, I don't know. You know, they're different eras.
Yeah, that's true.
Different areas.
Yeah.
So the Luke and Messi in touch to wonder, are Juventus genuinely really, really good? Or are Barcelona the most inconsistent of Europe's top teams at the moment? Well, I think both is a fair enough answer. Juventus, a 100% record at home in the league this year. They've won every game at home. They're 6 points clear in Serie A, going for their sixth consecutive league title. And they're struggling on without Paul Pogba, it seems.
They're getting by.
Dybala, who walked out of his press conference and said, I'm not the next Messi last night, but is rather good. Cuadrado there. Higuain has scored 27 goals in all competition. So Juventus are damn good. And maybe they feel like they're owed a Champions League. They were beaten in the final in 2015. And then Barcelona, well, I'm not really sure what Barcelona quite are at the moment.
Dybala had two touches in the penalty area in the first half. Two goals.
Yeah.
There's a sort of impressive efficiency about that.
So his two touches were his first goal?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I assume both goals are being counted in this qualification.
Yeah. He was just outside the area for the second
goal. Oh, was he just outside? Oh, yeah. Okay, well, he was, yeah.
Well, otherwise he had three touches.
Yeah. Well,
he didn't take his first goal.
The stats malfunctioned there. I have to go back to the drawing board there.
Yeah. I don't want to overawe you with big numbers of maths here, but we're talking about three touches.
Yeah, but Joe, I mean, I haven't actually watched the game myself and made a note of this. I'm clearly ripping off some other stat that I've seen someone put out there as part of the match analysis.
That's fine. That's how you print guys do journalism.
Yeah.
So it was a lovely, the first goal. Cuadrado played it into the area. It is back to goal. He took a touch with his right foot and then a pirouette. The ball didn't move and he kicked it down with his left into the far corner.
Took it nicely, yeah.
And then second goal, ball was played back to him, edge of the area. and he curled one back where it came from, around the defender, so the keeper
can't
quite see it.
Yeah, sort of near post even for the keeper, but still.
Yeah, oh, keeper precise. Might have saved it. Yeah. Got a hand to it.
And then the corner, and then Chiellini just stronger. So, Barca have had, again, they had 1-0, they had a chance at 2-0, they've had chances.
Yeah.
You know, Messi played one fantastic through ball to Iniesta. They've had moments in the game.
We'll talk to Paddy Agnew at full time. Like, Barcelona are just odd this year, difficult to make sense of. The comeback against PSG was quite extraordinary, and you know, maybe Neymar is a microcosm of Barcelona's season. He's been very patchy, very indifferent, and yet was so glorious in those closing few minutes, as there's maybe a chance for them. Oh, just wide, Suarez.
Yeah, one on one again, and they've, again, they've like, Juve are good defensively, and yet, I mean, Barca are capable of cutting open anyone, and there's a couple of great through balls they've played in this game.
Well, it was Messi who beat a man beautifully and then played a ball through for Suarez. It was down the right-hand channel, and Suarez, first time, maybe on the six-yard box at an angle, tried to just pass it into the far corner, went just wide. So, you know, Messi and Suarez are going to create
3-1 is an okay result. I mean, Neymar, I mean, as you mentioned, Neymar, and it's he is like microcosm of the season, even the erraticness. Like, he's out at the Clasico now for like sarcastically applauding the referee.
Yeah.
And that's going to hurt them. I mean, even.
It was so glorious for the final 10 minutes against PSG.
Oh, but that game is like, you know, the legacy of that game, you know, the rest of the season is in some ways, okay, that game is probably immortal, but if they're hammered in the next round and go out tamely, to me, like, the legend of that game is them winning the competition.
Yeah.
You know, that's how it's really cemented in status, is a wonderful moment.
They're having a good 4 or 5 minutes here.
They are piling it on.
Yeah.
I know, 3-1, you would fancy them to go through. You would. You definitely would.
They might have got a penalty there for a handball, to be honest.
Oh, Chiellini. Is his hand in an unnatural position there?
Yeah,
that's a penalty.
It's Neymar, edge of the area, who's striking a shot. And, oh, I'll tell you what happened there. There were two. There was Cuadrado sliding out to block him and Chiellini sliding out to block him. Chiellini had his right hand as he was sliding above his head. It hit him in the chest first and then hit his hand. Now, his hand is possibly a bit high to be sliding in, but it did hit his chest first, so you can't say it's deliberate. But then his hand wasn't in an unnatural position.
Yeah, it's tough. Did you see it the weekend?
What's a dribble?
Did you see it the weekend in the A-League, the Australian League, that they had the video referee there now? And the base, I think it was a penalty that was awarded a minute and a half after the initial offence happened.
Wow.
And then it was a really delayed response, and the video ref buzzed the truth to the referee and says, no, it's a penalty.
Yeah.
And you can see the players are sort of protesting, but they're sort of thinking, oh, well, the replay, they've seen the replay. And I guess you get the right decision, but I'm just thinking now, imagine like a 30 seconds time after this incident, all of a sudden, oh, it's a penalty now.
Would you give a penalty for that?
Well, this is the problem. I think you don't remove the element of debate from that decision. I think I probably would give a penalty for that, but you could argue a case the other way now, and I could say, yeah, okay, he's got a point there, you know?
There's a lot of decisions in football that replays won't clear
up. Well, you could see the players on the video referee decision in the A-League that they haven't seen the replay themselves.
Yeah.
So they're thinking, yeah, I might have handled that, so it probably looks like that in the replay. So there was no real anger. You know, it was almost a sort of a meek acceptance of it.
Yeah, they're certainly at a disadvantage when it comes to protesting, because the referee says, well,
I've seen it.
Some dude's just seen a replay.
I didn't give it.
Paddy Agnew's going to talk to us at full time. He's been watching this game. Borussia Dortmund's game, as I'm sure you've heard at this stage, against Monaco, postponed until tomorrow night. There were 3 explosions around their bus or on their bus, near their bus. We don't have all the exact details yet confirmed. Ahead of kickoff near the team hotel, there was a statement from local police. In the run-up to the Champions League game of Dortmund-Monaco, there was an explosion near the Dortmund team bus shortly before 7. According to current knowledge, the wheels of the bus burst. One person was injured. That's Barta, who's been taken to hospital, former Barcelona defender. Injury's not serious. It's not yet possible to say exactly what the explosion was or exactly where something exploded. So details are sketchy enough.
I think we'll be wiser about it tomorrow. Maybe people in the podcast wouldn't get Richie's news bulletin there, just pointing out that it has been reported that the Dortmund bus has extra strong glass, you know, like that they're sort of prepared for this in some shape or form. And you would assume that would have to be the case.
Marca, you know? And I, like, there's such a health warning over this. It's almost silly to say it, but Marca were reporting potentially that they were firecrackers. Don't know. It could well be. We don't know the nature of the explosive at this stage. So there's not so much more we can say about it, except that the game is going ahead tomorrow evening.
Yeah, so. I guess the fact that they're going ahead with the game at this point,
yeah,
that indicates in some way they've been suitably relaxed. Because, but then again, like UEFA are such slaves to their schedule that they're probably putting the squeeze on that pretty heavily as well.
Yeah, who knows? We'll get more detail over the next 24 hours. They're Dortmund, kind of a classy club and a host levels. As Juventus have another chance here and it's pulled wide.
Offside flag. Yeah.
They're a classy club and a host levels, the way they bring through youth talent, their ticket pricing, you know, for youths and old age pensioners, really good. And they've got a trending around the city now about beds for the night
for Monaco fans. Oh, the Monaco probably have around 9 fans, to be fair. You know, this is like, yeah, it'd be slightly more of a logistical difficulty if they were playing
find a hostel with 4 bunk beds.
Yeah, I mean, the Monaco lads are, you know, they're probably all right for a few quid in some cases.
They're probably staying the night anyway, but it's a nice gesture.
No, it's good. You know, German football as a whole is way more conscientious about these things than other leagues.
Yeah. Jim's been in touch. Controversy over the Lucan Messi.
Oh,
I'm from Lucan. It's Jim. I'm of Selbridge extraction, so I feel like I got a feel for Lucan.
Selbridge extraction, I like it.
Yeah. I've been around Lucan. I know my way around those streets.
You know your way. Yeah.
Played football in Lucan. I've seen what they have to offer.
You're not the Lucan Messi though. You're just like the.
I couldn't possibly say what I am.
The Selbridge Malawi, basically.
The Selbridge what? The Selbridge Sea.
Yeah.
I'm from Lucan, and we have no one who has the right to call himself Messi. Says Jim. A few Paul McShanes, maybe, but no Messi.
Yeah.
Has anyone seen the Walkinstown Beckenbauer play? I don't know.
I mean, presumably he hasn't played in 40 years.
Let's run through some of the other news of the day. So Ronald Koeman popped up in Donegal.
Yeah, off to see Seamus Coleman with Phil Jagielka and the fitness coach. So I suppose, you know, Seamus Coleman hiding his phone in case Martin O'Neill happened to ring at that point. You know, awkward discussions.
I've Ronald here, do you want a word?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we'll see what the timeline is with Coleman. We're still waiting for that. It's a nice thing to do. It's a nice thing to make him.
Do you know what? I thought it was a nice thing to do.
That's it. There's no cynical intention there, really, I don't think. I think he's a pretty popular fellow within football. You go and see him. Okay, I mean, someone poses to get the photo taken. I guess you're putting it out there. But I think maybe, you know, with someone like Coleman, like, you have a serious injury and we all are up in arms over it. But this is probably the loneliest period now when it's just gone out of the news cycle and all of a sudden he's really facing up to this period of, oh, crap, you know. Yeah. And maybe that is the time where you want your club to step in and be there, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing to do in that context.
I know, it's good touch, yeah, because there's no short-term game for Koeman to do that. But
No, there isn't. I mean, like, could Coleman have been going in the summer in normal circumstances? Could their relationship have been different? Very possibly, but, you know, he's their man now. I mean, you only have to look at, this has actually been very negative, but, like, Alan Judge, who's been out for a year with an injury now, and he's had further surgery because of complications with this break that he had. And he's now signed a new contract at Brentford last week because, you know, you have to, all of a sudden you need that support and security around you. Okay, I know these lads are earning huge money and so on, but still, you know, when that happens, you want your club to sort of be there with you all the way through, because you do hear stories that not every club always covers themselves in glory in that scenario.
Yeah. The scenery was very nice behind them as well. They obviously took them out somewhere around the Wild Atlantic Way.
It's a nice place, Donegal.
Oh, well, listen, I know. So that popped up on our screens today. That's a nice gesture from Koeman. You wanted to mention the World Cup bid involving the US, Mexico and Canada. So a joint bid to host the 2026 World Cup. I've had the kind of day where I haven't had time to click on this headline. So is there anything interesting?
Well, I think what's interesting is that they're looking to, I mean, okay, the bare facts, you know, the USA, Mexico, Canada want to host the World Cup in 2026. CONCACAF is due its spin because 1994 was the last one.
Europe and Asia can't host it again. Like, literally, like, there's a rule. They can't.
Yeah, it's effectively, it's on a cycle. So you're looking at maybe Australia or someone being an alternative. But the interesting snippet here, I guess, ESPN are now reporting that the CONCACAF bid, they're basically looking for a unique window, 6 months, where prepare a report that shows their technical aspects. Long story short, they're looking to forego the bid process here.
Just give
it to
us. Saying,
hey, listen, USA, Canada, Mexico, I think 60 games in USA, 10 in the other two. Just give it to us.
Yeah.
Just give it to us. You know, I think really after the potential damage that could be done by Russia and Qatar, you do think that, you know, a USA dominated tournament, fantastic stadiums, fairly accessible, apart from, you know, we'll see whatever
wall,
you know,
dependent
what sort of wall dependent access there is, but generally it has the potential to be a very good tournament.
Yeah.
And really, I don't know who's going to go up ahead of that. People would say, well, three hosts, how would that affect qualification places? I think that's just going to chip away at CONCACAF's places. It's not going to have any impact on Europe or other places.
There's also about a billion teams allowed at this World Cup, so
yeah, there's 48 teams that everyone will find a way somehow. Yeah. But I think maybe it's what the World Cup might need. I think just, you know, Russia, there's stories every day about Russia and their sort of shambolic attempts to portray some kind of anti-racism task force and not even withstanding sort of current affairs and the problems that you face with Russia and Qatar, this is a bit of a no-brainer. I'm not sure if Trump's had a say in it yet.
A spokesperson for the US Football Association said President Trump is supportive of the bid and he encouraged it.
Yeah,
which
he hasn't tweeted
nice.
About it yet, which is the official Donald Trump.
I have no idea there's a bid happening, for God's sake. He doesn't have a clue. It's news to him.
No, but there's, I think people...
Interestingly, when they moved the tournament he hosted, the WGC in golf, from America to Mexico,
oh, yeah, yeah.
His one comment was, well, I hope they have good kidnap insurance. So presumably, that extends to Mexico hosting a World Cup as well.
Because I have to say, if there was one, I might say this far, if there was one sporting event I would like to have gone to back in time, it'd be like Ireland, Italy, in New York. New York, fantastic city. The history of the Irish community, the Italian community, what an event that must have been to attend. And you just think, you know, where would you like to see Ireland play in a tournament?
Yeah.
You know, in the States or in Canada, particularly with, you know, people, you know, Irish people around the place. It could be something special. So maybe a major tournament to look forward to in the future.
Yeah.
Which would be a good thing, I think.
Still Juventus 3, Barcelona 0, 79 minutes on the clock. One of the big talking points of the last 24 hours, obviously the Arsenal game. I was saying to the lads earlier, I think we're gone beyond the point of playing some Arsenal fan TV, that I was, you know, just, what's the point?
Just play, just like the control, it's the copy and paste of audio almost, you know, you've heard it.
Although, you know, I added that was because I had sorted out last night in bed and watched it. Watched it all.
And was it as... I don't know, you're taunting people by not playing it now, but I assume it was up to the usual standard.
There were guys I'd never even seen before. There was one lad who just started singing, but they all understood what he was doing. They went nuts for him. You know, I mean, so if you go back to like the original, the classic, Claude and T.
Yeah.
So T is all, and still is, saying, you know, Wenger, he has to be allowed to choose when he goes. I support him. He's the small guy with the glasses.
Yeah, he'd be like the good cop almost.
Kind
in this,
of.
In this,
and
in
Claude's like the taller, booming, no, yeah, no, yeah. I've had it, guy.
The milk guy.
Yeah. So what happened last night was he was very down, obviously, but he was still saying, no, man, we've got to trust him. Yeah, just...
He's almost like that. If you ever watch Fox News, they get this sort of somewhat sort of left leaning guy on it just to get.
He was a sympathetic character, and even the mild mannered presenter was saying, "But come on, T, this is bad." And he's like, "No, I know it's bad, but it'll get better. We're a better team than this. It's going to get better." But he was very sad, and what was striking was that Claude didn't interrupt him this time, and Claude said, "I don't even have the energy to interrupt T anymore." So in effect, it was quite interesting to watch, but it wouldn't be as dramatic to play.
No, Claude is mastering. He knows. Claude's like, listen, what more can I say?
I tell you who was angry, though, is Jamie Carragher after Theo Walcott came out and gave this whole routine.
What's the biggest disappointment? The result or the performance?
Biggest thing would be letting the fans down tonight. You know, we all did. That's not Arsenal at all. You know, we thought we've bounced back well, obviously, against Man City at home and West Ham, and tonight wasn't us at all. We're very disappointed in that dressing room.
That's honest of you. When you hear them singing "You're Not Fit to Wear the Shirt," is it difficult to argue with?
Obviously, everyone's entitled to an opinion there. You know, we haven't got a problem with that. We want to try and do a job. We don't go out there to lose games, of course. We try and work our best we can. And tonight, it just didn't happen. And like I said, all we can do is apologise for that performance tonight.
Why do you think it was? You know how much you need the points for the top four players. Why didn't it happen?
You know, I think they just wanted it more. You could tell they wanted it more. Could sense that, you know, from the kickoff. And it was just, you know, it was an uphill battle towards the end there. And like I said before, this isn't Arsenal at this moment in time. Like I said before, we thought we got out of this little patch and, you know, hopefully we haven't been dragged straight back into it. But judging that performance tonight, it looks like it has.
Forget top four. It's got nothing to do with it in my eyes, in terms of Arsenal top four. It's been a nonsense for 5 or 6 years, that. go for the trophies, not top four, and that has affected the whole club, where they've lost that something special they had. Going back to George Graham era, you think of Arsenal, you're thinking, you've got a right game on your hand now. Now there's weakness there. But these players, I mean, I think the best description of the players, I think it was 2 years ago, I think of Graeme Souness. He said they're a team of son-in-laws. But what father would want his daughter to bring one of them on? I'm serious. Bottling it, cowards, ducking out of challenges. What type of man would you want to bring your daughter home? One of them? No, I just think from top to bottom, this club is not right.
Someone earlier did make the point, like, if Alexis Sanchez came home with my daughter and his pay packet, I'd run down the street naked and celebrate. Fair reservation. Like, what did you... So, one of Cara's big gripes... Cara, I don't know the man. One of Carragher's big gripes with Walcott was that he felt that Walcott was knowingly playing the game. You come out, you give the honest answer...
Posturing.
You get some praise from the fans. At least he's telling it like it is. And Cara thought, do you know what? I see through this. I know what Walcott's doing here, and I actually don't like it. Do your talking on the pitch. Don't be coming on looking for this praise, to be honest. Now, equally... if Walcott comes on and is not honest, maybe he gets criticised too. Like, the Walcott interview is extraordinary in that, well, one, he says this isn't Arsenal.
But that was the killer line for me.
and two, he said, oh, it was just obvious from kickoff, from the first few minutes of the game, they wanted it more than us. You know, it's almost, and I know it's not what he means, but it's as if Arsenal are somehow powerless to change the tide. You know, we started the game and it became apparent they wanted the game more than us. So, yeah, our goose was cooked. And you just think that is so pathetic.
Yeah, I think if Roy Keane is saying about a team he's part of, well, his language will be different, but you'd know he's aiming at players here. You know, but you can't really just avoid this, that this is Theo sending out a message to the other fellas in the dressing room. Yeah. I can't imagine they're sitting out there going, geez, Theo's out there. God, do you reckon he's going to slaughter us? You know?
No.
Don't want to talk to him on the team bus on the way home. It wasn't the most convincing explanation for it there. You know, it's the biggest thing is the fans. You can be sure if Arsenal somehow bounce back from this and put a winning run together, the interview would be, a lot of people wrote us off, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people taking a lot of stick this year. You know, so, well, you've apologised after games. Well, that tends to be forgotten at that point. Mm. Now, I'm not sure if they're really going to go on that run, really. And I think he's, you know, Carragher's words... I can understand him. I see he's gotten a spat with Richard Keyes today then. Have you seen that?
No.
Richard Keyes...
But already I'm interested.
I think Richard Keyes had a go at Carragher, something along the lines of, you know, what about your own Liverpool team that finished in the top four, you know, for numerous seasons and, you know, didn't win the league? And then Carragher hit back at him. You might be able to dig it up there.
Oh, I'm doing that.
But then Carragher has a pop back at Keyes. It was a couple of hours ago. Because Richard Keyes is such a established Twitter presence, but he always likes to have a little dig at Neville and Carragher. He can never buy the Neville and Carragher love.
Yeah.
So Keyes decides to get involved then.
Well, they've piggybacked on what him and Andy created,
yeah,
you know?
They made it.
So here we go. Arsenal cowards. You can't say that at Carragher23, not when you've played. Remember how you reacted when Adrian Durham called you out over England?
Oh, I missed that part of the discussion.
See, it's very complicated because there's an awful lot of people getting involved in the replies just enjoying this. Should I get the popcorn? No. No. It's just a million people writing back abusing Richard Keyes. Someone has a giant picture of Keyes.
I think every time...
In giant letters, it just says, it was just banter.
Every time Keyes starts, he takes that. But I think then Cara eventually does get involved. You know, because then Keyes pops up, what would your verdict be on the Liverpool players that failed time and again to win the title down the years? And Carragher comes back in.
Oh, I got it. Sorry.
Yeah.
So Arsenal cares. You can't say that Carragher 23, blah, blah, blah. What, you know, remember how you reacted when Adrian Durham called you out over England? Cara retweeted that and said, I can and I did. And I'm glad you tuned in for real Monday Night Football, Richard. Which Keyesy would not have liked.
No.
There's only one real Monday Night Football and that's on in Qatar.
Yeah, with
a slightly sad Andy Gray and Richard Keyes pretending everything's okay.
It's all fine. They're setting the agenda out there.
Hey, listen, everybody's watching us. More people watch us out here than ever watched us in the UK. Although all poor Richard cares about is the UK media.
No.
You could tell Richard Keyes every other country bar England is paying attention to what you're saying. It wouldn't be enough.
No. But I mean, he's still trying to tell you that everything's all right in Qatar as well.
Everything's great in Qatar.
I mean, there's loads of people watching. I mean, their masters let them watch it. You know, it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. So was there anything else then?
But then it blots away. Well, what would your verdict be on the Liverpool players that failed time and again to win the title down the years? Carragher says, teams I played in failed in winning the Premier League because of ability, not character. But then adds again, interested in what your verdict is on why you failed to keep your job at Sky? Not heard you mention it before.
Oh, good stuff. That's fantastic.
11, the slightly boring one, you know, teams I played in failed winning the Premier League because of ability, not character. Just the 400 retweets for that. 12,000 retweets for the follow-up line about why did you lose your job at Sky?
See, Carragher's obviously talking to people at Sky and getting the inside word.
Yeah.
You know, Carragher's sitting down around the canteen going, so what was the deal with Keezy?
And he
and I think he's heard some stuff.
He's thinking, I'll just put this out there. I'll just send it out there. In fairness to Carragher and Neville, I mean, they are good on Sky, but they use the Twitter world to their advantage as well. I mean, they'll call people out, but they know they have a sort of a backing behind them to get stuck in on their behalf too.
88 minutes on the clock. Still 3-0. Juventus, Barcelona on the attack. Comes to nothing. Rakitic tried to volley across, but it went high and over the bar. We don't really have time to get into it, but just as we leave the Arsenal theme, it's just worth mentioning. It's probably worth digging out, especially if you're an Arsenal fan or interested. Mesut Ozil is bringing out an autobiography, and he did an interview, I think, with Rob Draper. It was certainly in the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, the most striking thing is the line opens, the opener of the piece, I may actually have it here, is about rats.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It was about his upbringing in Gelsenkirchen, which Ireland played in Gelsenkirchen recently, and it's a pretty grim place, it must be said, and it has a reputation for being a grim place. And basically, I think he was speaking about where he grew up in pretty sort of squalid environment, and it wasn't a fantastic place. And really, Ozil went on from that into like explaining his Turkish roots and how Ozil at times, I think, in German football parlance has been held up as an example of like the modern Germany, that they have a team from all different backgrounds and all different communities, and that, you know, that there's been periods in his history in German football where Ozil has been the golden boy because of that, but also he's struggled as well at times. He's basically trying to explain this is his identity. It's not just the German guy, his grandparents moved there, he grew up there, but also he's very conscious of his Turkish background. He says he goes there a lot, actually. He still visits Turkey on a regular basis.
Well, he said when he went to a lot of trials as a youngster that he was quite often the best player on the pitch and was not picked up by the clubs, and his father said it's because you're Turkish.
Yeah, I think the 2006 World Cup for Germany was, you know, flagged, and then the World Cup winning team then, you know, was flagged as a celebration of, you know, the modern Germany and the various players from various backgrounds.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been plain sailing for him along the way, and he's been the boo boy target at certain times, and there've always been. I suppose questions about what lays at the root of some of that criticism he's received in Germany.
Yeah.
That is.
Well, interestingly, he's been National Team Player of the Year for 5 out of 6
years. Yeah, his record is amazing.
I hadn't realised that. But the headline-grabbing stuff is the opener to the article where Rob Draper writes, it was the rats that most traumatised Mesut Ozil. Almost everything else about his childhood growing up in Bulkham, Holland, a mini Turkish enclave in the German city of Gelsenkirchen, seems to have been generally positive. And it talked about, it was fairly grim, you know, he didn't have a bed, so he slept on a mattress on the floor, which was stored away during the day. And his father was a cleaner, father a factory worker, and there was a cellar downstairs in the apartment block where he had his bike, and the children would never go down and get the bikes on their own. He says, it was like that at the time. I was pretty small. I was always the youngest in our group. When you went into the cellar, there wasn't an on or off button for the light. You pressed the button and 30 seconds later, the light would go off again. You wouldn't know where things were because it was so dark. And then you'd hear the noises. When you see such a big rat in front of you, it would freak you out. I always went down with others and never on my own. So,
it's strange, for
a guy who's talked about as silver spoon in the mouth type player, soft.
He's not a winner. Well, actually, I mean, well, aside from that, he's won a lot of trophies, but I know the general point, he's soft, blah, blah, he goes missing. Like, he's already a winner, really.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in terms of where he's come from.
Now, I would be critical of him in his play at times. Like, I thought in their last Champions League match, he didn't try a leg. But I mean, it's clearly not some kind of weakness in character.
Well, like, I guess, you know, but I thought it was interesting that he's so bedded, still remains very bedded to his background. And, like, they are the things that are important to him in his life. And, of course, like, his, you know, every day he should be striving for excellence in where he is. But, you know, the troubles of Arsenal are possibly not something that's going to keep him awake at night, really, you know, when you've come from a slightly different background.
Yeah, he spoke very highly of Wenger, said that was the reason he joined and said he wants him to stay. So that was, it's worth checking out if you're an Arsenal fan. It's in the Mail on Sunday. And, geez, just the image. Imagine being a kid, getting your bike, you turn on the switch, the light goes off after 30 seconds, you still haven't got to your bike. It's somewhere 10, 15 metres ahead of you, and you know there's a giant rat somewhere in front of you as well.
Yeah.
That's no good.
That's daily.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess he probably became conditioned to it as well.
Maybe, yeah. 3-0, 2 minutes of the four of added time are up, and Paddy Agnew has been watching this game, so we'll talk to Paddy next.
News Talks Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
Thanks to Air, with UEFA Champions and Europa Leagues action. Brought to you by Air Sport.
You're very welcome back. It's Joe here and Dan here, and it's gone full time in Turin, and it's been fairly emphatic stuff. Juventus 3, Barcelona 0. 2 goals from Dybala, Chiellini with a header. 3-0, that's the first leg done and dusted. Paddy Agnew is on the line, whose work you'll read in World Soccer. Evening, Paddy.
Good evening, Joe.
So, 3-0 suggests a fairly emphatic victory. Was it that kind of a game?
Well, it's a very tough game. If you watched the last 20 minutes of it, you wouldn't, and you didn't know the scoreline, you wouldn't have been quite so convinced that Juventus were winning 3-0, because Barcelona did not start well. Juventus started very well, but Barcelona did have a period in the last 20 minutes when they played a little bit like the Barcelona of old, and they certainly put Juventus under a huge amount of pressure. And I'd say Juventus can feel very satisfied that they didn't concede a goal in that period. And I would say at this point the tie is done and dusted. Juventus are in the semi-final because, you know, Juventus are not Paris Saint-Germain. They're not going to concede 6 goals or even 3 goals at the Camp Nou.
In what sense did Barcelona start badly, or were Juventus just brilliant and forced them to look a bit sluggish? Like, because Barcelona's form has been iffy. They came into this game on the back of that defeat. Like, did they look flat-footed, or how did they set up, or could they just not get a foothold in the game?
I think it's most the last thing you said there. I think Juventus were absolutely up for this game, as they've been up for the Champions League all season long. They've played some of their best football in the Champions League, and they started the game on a buzz. Like, Khedira had a shot very early on, Higuain had a wrong goal very early on. They looked like they were they meant business from the start, and they looked as they are. They looked like a side they were absolutely brimming with confidence. They're, you know, they've had a very good period in the last 10 days. Qualified for the Italian Cup final, beating even though they lost to Napoli, holding Napoli in the previous 3 days earlier in a really important league game. They are on top of form. In contrast, Barcelona looked to me like a side that are just a little bit unsure of themselves, and they only began to look like the Barcelona that we've known and admired in the last half hour.
Paddy, I mean, how do people in Italy speak? I know Juventus have been dominant in the last couple of years, but do they speak about Juventus there as being a great team, or how are they perceived in Italy at the moment?
Well, I don't think people so much, but people always acknowledge that Juventus are by far the best side in Italian football at the moment. Whether this is a great team, I'm not so sure how much people say that, in the sense that the AC Milan side of Hullet and Van Basten and Rijkaard and Baresi was a great team because they won the league, but they also won the Champions Cup 3 or 4 times. Juventus, really, to be considered a great team, would have to win the Champions League, I would think. And a lot of people tend to suggest that their dominance in the league here is an indication of how Serie A isn't quite as good as it used to be, because they're, you know, one of the 3 or 4 really good sides. Whereas if they actually want to earn that title of, you know, great team, a Champions League success is required.
We talked pre-match with Tim Vickery of the BBC over in South America, because there's such a South American flavour to this game, and obviously we know plenty about Neymar and Suarez, but we focused in on Dybala beforehand with him, and it's not like we're unaware of Dybala's talents, and he was signed 2 years ago for 40 million and he's 23 years old, and said last night in his press conference, "I'm not the next Messi, stop saying that to me." tonight feels like something of an announcement on this absolutely elite stage for him. How highly do you rate him, Paddy? How good can this guy be?
I think he's very, very good. I mean, you know, people who know more than me, Beppe Bergman, for example, the guy who won the World Cup as an 18-year-old in 1982, he said to me the other day that, you know, the best player at Juventus last season was Dybala. One of the few problems that Juventus have had this season has been that he hasn't been in his best form. He's had a couple of injury problems, Dybala, but he's coming back from injury, and in the last couple of league games he's looked very sharp, and tonight he looked very, very good. Mm. He's a fantastic player. I mean, definitely he's an in the box player, in the sense of, like, you know, he's what we used to call an inside forward. He's got a very good vision of the game. Can play off either foot. Mm. And he's got a very good, seems to have worked out a very good understanding with Higuain. And the two Argentines up front are a serious problem for anybody.
Mm. So Manchester United fans listening in are rightly thinking that Juve have managed to chug along without Paul Pogba.
Well, you know, a lot of people would say that the Juventus midfield is not as good this year as it was when Pogba was there. And I would tend to think that too, because Pogba managed to combine a lot of physical presence, a lot of manpower, as well as a lot of skill. And there's nobody quite like that in this current midfield. You have basically Pjanic and Khedira playing deep. Mm. But the two of them don't quite match up to Pogba. However, you could also argue that this Juventus has that Allegri's come up with a very good formula in the way he plays Mandzukic alongside Dybala and Cuadrado, that he's behind Higuain. It's a much more attack-oriented side than a lot of Serie A teams over in recent years.
Yeah, well, Paddy, just going with that then, if they are slightly more attack-orientated, but how do you think they will approach the second leg? I know you've said they're not PSG, but do you think Allegri will go and try and sit in then, or how do you think they will approach it?
I can't see him approaching it. I'm sure on the eve of the match he'll be saying, you know, we're not here for a draw, we're here to win, and you know, if you go out looking for a draw, you're going to get hammered, etc., etc. And to a certain extent, he'll mean that, but to in another sense, he'll feel very much that that, you know, we've done three quarters of the job in Turin, and we just have to hold on to what we've got. I mean, it was Bonucci said it yesterday. The Juventus central defender said it yesterday. You know, well, he was the person actually said, we're not Paris Saint Germain. We wouldn't have conceded six goals like that.
Yeah, Paddy, brilliant stuff. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you,
Paddy Agnew there, who watched Juve 3-0, and in Paddy's opinion, anyway, this one's done. They ain't PSG. I would tend to agree with that.
Yeah, there's one less goal required. You know, this is the only thing.
Yeah.
You know, if Barca go one up, it doesn't seem as daunting a position to be in without stating the bloody obvious.
That's
but
true.
I thought interesting. His point is about the more attacking element of it. You do think certainly they're capable of scoring, in which case you're talking about five goals, and it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe, but this could be another sting that's played out in a couple of weeks' time when Barcelona scored five. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think Barcelona will do it, Dan.
Yes, I think they're certainly to go through.
Can we make sure that's saved so we have it in the can? There's an interview that's really, really good. Oliver Kay in The Times. I know you read it on Monday. And it's worth digging out if people can. Obviously, The Times, London Times, is behind a paywall.
Pay for it.
Yeah, it must be hard to get for free.
Yeah, there probably is some scam. So, Matt Janssen interview.
Yeah. Remind people of Matt Janssen.
Matt Janssen, I think we'll go for it. Yeah.
He came back to me because it's not like he was a bad player by any means, but it's been a while.
Yeah, well, there have been in the Premier League era, and certainly the last 15, 16 years, some promising young English strikers that tailed off for various reasons. I mean, there was Franny Jeffers, there was like Dean Ashton, who was very unlucky with injury, and then there was Matt Janssen, who I think he went from Carlisle, it was, to Blackburn. Certainly one of these guys that was talked up in the lower leagues, went to Blackburn and looked like a sensational player, sort of an incredible talent.
Yeah.
And
start with how he had to retire.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, Matt Janssen was at the peak of his powers coming up to the 2001-2002 season, coming up towards the World Cup in Japan and Korea. He was meant to be in the squad. I think he missed an important game where he's meant to play with Michael Owen. Yeah, gastroenteritis. He missed that game. And in the end, Sven, despite giving Graeme Souness, who was then manager, indications that he might be in, turned out he wasn't. He wasn't in the squad.
Yeah, so
next day he was out.
He doesn't make the World Cup squad, so he says, you know what? Him and the missus, let's go to Rome and get away from it all.
Went to Rome to get away from it all. And effectively, he was involved in a scooter accident when he was in. I remember the story at the time that he'd been knocked over in Rome and he was okay. That was the short version of it. You know, it wasn't something where his life was in balance. But then, I think a statement at the time from Blackburn said he'd suffered concussion and minor cuts and bruises. Mm. Janssen in this interview says the reality was far more serious, or Oliver Kay says, sorry, on the strength of Janssen's words, he had suffered a brain hemorrhage and spent 5 days in a coma. Mm. He suffered memory loss for months after the accident. And I remember he came back playing and he was a shadow of his old self. And he basically, in this interview, is very honest. Yeah, I think the odd flash of magic. I think he scored one great goal against Liverpool, but his confidence was gone. Mm. Every day in training, he was just, why couldn't he do things like he used to before? And it had a weight at him. Really powerful stuff about how his ego was destroyed by this fall from grace.
Well, so it's interesting the effect has. Like the accident, you know, it seems so just minor. I guess he's 200 or 300 metres from going back to the apartment. There were some cars double parked, bumper to bumper. And so he just leant his head forward to see if there was anything coming, and it turns out a taxi smashed him, and it's just nothing. But when he recovers, and then when he's back in training, like when he's not himself, he was saying that I was suddenly thinking about what had always come naturally. Before the accident, it had been natural playing football, that is, like driving a car. And now I was thinking about it. Because of that, I was losing a split second and I would get dispossessed. I was saying, I'm not right. Started to doubt myself. The fear comes in. I stopped wanting the ball. I started to hate football. And it was a long process, but it became a vicious circle. And ultimately, as you said, the flashes of brilliance. But he says football was full-time misery. I was in tears constantly, hating it. Can't do it. Can't cope with it. I was on antidepressants, which weren't any good. I was on other stuff. I don't think I would ever have committed suicide. I wouldn't have had the balls to do it, but I was crying for help. So
very grim. Awful. I mean, at 28, basically, you know, he was done. But the context of the piece is, I think he might be working on a book, but also he is actually back managing now with Chorley Town. I think he had a partnership with Gary Flitcroft, another name from the sort of memory lane. He's making waves at non-league football management level. I think he mentioned he'd bumped into Paul Scholes recently at a game, and Scholes and him were both agreeing that they love non-league football now. It's way more pure and they enjoy the life down there, and it seems like he's actually reignited his love for football. So there is a sort of a happy end to this story, even if it cost them maybe the better years of a career, which seemed like it was on the way up to a point of serious success, but he's managed to somehow regain some kind of affection for the game all these years later.
Scholes said to him, take this over the Premier League any day. Mm. Much preferred.
And you can imagine Scholes saying those exact words.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I can imagine. All right. So, I hadn't realised Janssen had gone through all that, to be honest. Has come out the other end, but it was fairly grim times, such an innocuous thing. So it's worth checking out the piece in full. Like, there's loads of great strong quotes in it, so it's in the London Times with Oliver Kay, Matt Janssen interview. Some texts in. I wish this had come in from John earlier. Lads, I'm tucking into a plate of spaghetti bolognese because I've got a craving for Italian food. Got it earlier on. I wonder, is the flip side true for Paddy? Does he ever crave a bowl of Irish stew? I'm sure he does, but I would have liked to ask Paddy that.
Sure, Paddy's a man of means. I'm sure he's able to rustle one off somehow.
And somebody else says, why did Mesut Ozil not just bring a torch to get his bike?
Well, there you go. I'm guessing the context is they probably couldn't afford one.
I would think that is the context. He didn't have a bed. So, well, it's a pity that the old cellar didn't have a light that you could turn on and off.
Someone should have proposed at the time, Joe. Or you needed someone like you around the house just to make suggestions.
Or give it a minute. You know, 30 seconds, the light goes off.
Plenty of time.
Well, he's sorry. To run and get
plenty
his bike.
Time.
We're
plenty
rats
of
over
time.
There.
Well, to teach him to be competitive, get the bike quickly.
It's where he got his speed. Time.
Life skills straight away. That's talk. Excellent parenting.
You haven't just been here the whole time. You've just walked in.
I have indeed. Yes,
you're on the way after 10.
I am indeed. I was trying to make sense of your conversation about Italian food and Irish stew.
We had Paddy Agnew on
right.
from Rome. He was watching Juve do their thing, and somebody was wondering, does Paddy you know, get the craving for Irish food?
He'd
or
have
is he
to.
Is he all Italian?
Irish stew is a wonderful meal. Absolutely wonderful. Although probably not suited to Italy where it's warm. Suited on a cold day in Ireland.
That'd be the problem, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah. A cold day in North Italy could do the
maybe,
stew.
Maybe, maybe.
You're not fully committing
to
that.
I think being freezing and wanting kind of warmth.
It's peasant food, of course, Tom.
Yeah, being in a warm room, looking out at the rain and the misery and thinking, oh, this is great food. This yeah. is keeping me away from things.
Like, to be honest, pasta bolognese is quite comforting
beautiful.
Too.
Didn't you know? Exist in Ireland
way,
until the
yeah.
mid-70s.
Yeah.
You know? Mid-70s?
Yeah, invented. And arrived in Ireland in the mid-70s.
I, don't think
I remember it arriving.
I don't think I passed it until I was about 15.
Yeah, I'd say I was in my 20s.
Well, I was born...
You know,
I've less of an excuse.
much later.
There's a couple of years later. Between those two
born
times.
I can remember 70s. Being suspicious of Italian food. I can
remember
going
coming
to people's
in.
Houses.
It's a big thing.
It's always somebody else's house, never our house.
Yeah.
My mother, it says, still never tasted.
Was it big news when it came in?
It was. Now and again, you'd be invited to somebody's house and they'd have lasagna and it was just, who do they think they are?
Wow.
Who do they look at Fancy Dan.
I have to say, I'm just so glad I was born when I was. I just think another generation or two before me, I wouldn't fancy that at all in this country.
They don't know what potatoes are for, young people these days.
No.
They know nothing.
Well, potatoes are gone. They
not in
long.
My world.
There was a big campaign there last year to try and get people back having potatoes because my generation think they take too bloody long to cook.
Yeah, pushing an open door at me, no trouble getting me back on them.
They do take a long time to cook.
Where are the potatoes, I often ask.
Do you boil them?
No, cut them very small and then roast them. That's the key.
Would you?
Tiny bit of oil over them, bit of salt.
But you'd boil past in
25 minutes.
You'd boil past in 10, Tom.
They're more worth waiting for. It's delay pleasure.
That's the age old potato be past the debate again.
What's on the way?
Future Islands, new album. Father John Misty, the new album. Take me a while to warm to it, but it's very, very good.
Okay.
Bob Dylan's album is gorgeous. Wait. It's all the American songbook stuff.
Right.
It's really beautiful. And I'll be telling people what I was doing last night. Whew. I did something very special last night.
Can you tell us? No, just save it for your show.
All right.
Okay.
Cooked a few potatoes.
It's on the way.
Far from potatoes.
Non-potato related. On the way after 10.
News Talks Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
Thanks to AIR, with UEFA Champions and Europa Leagues action. Brought to you by AIR Sport.
Two texts in. One not so important, but a good line. Dermot says, newsflash, Arsenal and potatoes gone.
Mm.
Which is important.
It could probably be mashed fairly easily as well.
And then a lovely tweet from Mick Reynolds. Mick says, Super Radio guys, I'm heading for my last chemo session tomorrow. So got me in a good morning going in. You guys make a difference. Good man.
That's lovely, yeah.
Mick, best of luck. I'm delighted to hear it's your last chemo session. So keep us up to date with things. Mick Reynolds there. Good man. Good to hear from you. So we will conclude the evening. There is no new news from Dortmund.
No.
Match will take place tomorrow. We'll have more details on what happened in the next 24 hours, the nature of the explosives. Hopefully, just for everybody's mood and anxiety levels, it's not as serious as it could be. And the match will go ahead tomorrow. And in other news, Barcelona, we're pretty much saying they're gone. This is it, seriously. This team, the squad has not been replenished. There's no depth to this squad.
But they've been, I mean, I think there's several times, and you listen to Graham on a Thursday, there's been several times this season where it's like, oh God, they've lost their fear factor. Teams aren't afraid of them. I think that is the thing. There was an element of fear of Barcelona, but I think now reasonably good teams have copped that if you go in with a really positive mindset against them, you can do them.
Yeah.
And there was a point before where you just felt, God, if you commit bodies here in any way, you're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
But you can, you know, you realise that Barca are defending with six or seven players and the rest aren't sort of doing that much coming back. It's like, well, you know, execute a plan. It's easy said. I still, part of me thinks they'll give this a go in the second leg.
Sure.
They'll give it a real go. It's going to be fantastic. It was a good game tonight from what we saw of it. I think the second leg is going to be extraordinarily good.
If Barcelona get an early goal, Kevin Kliban's finger will be quivering over the bet. he'll be checking the odds because you kind of feel if they get one, the whole place will go nuts and it could just go.
Yeah, well, I mean, just do it before the game and, you know, that's the...
Don't bet at all.
Just don't do it, actually. Bad idea.
So tomorrow there's Real Madrid against Bayern.
Well, potentially three games tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not to be sort of very sort of facetious about the whole thing, but if that Dortmund game does go ahead early, then it's a pretty sort of epic day's football.
That'll be a goal fest.
You would have thought so, yeah. That I think that certainly that seems to be the expectation again from looking at those dreaded odds. But certainly they're going to be good games.
Yeah. Well, Kilbane is back in tomorrow. Jerry's back in. I'll be here as well, and we'll be all over the football. There'll be Wednesday night rugby and some more besides. So we'll talk to you then. Tom Dunn with his special announcement on the way.
Give my ball any yard of grass. I'll give you a move for the perfect pass.